I'm really delighted to be here. I'm happy that there are so many people here, and I want to get through what I'm going to talk about relatively quickly so that we can have some discussion about the conference and the conference topics. And my hope is that we can incorporate some of your thoughts into what we end up doing on February 24th, which is coming up more quickly than I would like to admit. So Beyond Broadcast this year is called, of course, From Participatory Culture to Participatory Democracy. We're sort of riffing on last year, which was the first year we did the conference. We called it Reinventing Public Broadcasting in a Participatory Culture. We had a lot of fantastic participation from a broad spectrum of folks in public broadcasting and then from social media more broadly. I'm just going to play a short video clip of Jake Shapiro and Chris Lydon, both Berkman Fellows, from last year's conference to give you a sense of what we talked about, and then we'll jump into this year.
And the potential at the intersection of traditional public media
So I like Chris's framing of that. And I think that this year we sort of take that question and extend it further. So last year we started with public media asking, what is the public? What does it mean to go from something which has been traditionally called public broadcasting to something more broadly called public media or social media? And what does the internet mean in that? Beginning to discuss how public media fits into participatory culture, as we're all starting to talk about this term. What does it mean to turn public broadcasting from a one-way medium to something that's more two-way, to something that's more interactive? The idea for this year was, especially in the context, the current political context of being between the midterm elections and leading up to the presidential elections, what can we understand in terms of the way that our media is reshaping the way that we participate in democracy as we go from media that has been traditionally broadcast one way, where we've engaged with the political process through being receivers and then voting on election day. How does that change the way that we can potentially engage as citizens? So we're trying to sort of extend the theme forward, and from some of the things that we learned last year, some of the technologies that we explored, say, what does this mean in the broader political space? I should say at the beginning of this, we didn't want this to be just a conference about how to get out the vote or how the internet might change elections, although that's certainly a big part of the conversation. We wanted to look more broadly at when you define politics in a more all-encompassing way, and when you look at the sort of larger political economy, how is the internet changing that as well, and how is the shift from broadcast to other modes changing? So the first thing we had to do was come up with great graphics. This was from last year. It was a satellite dish. It was especially appropriate in the context of public broadcasting because the core distribution infrastructure of public broadcasting is actually satellite-based, and then it goes out to the broadcast tower. So we needed something new for this year. So I fell in love with this image. I think it's great because it's some kind of a transmitter tower. It looks like there's a microwave antenna up there. Maybe that's a cell or something. I'm not sure. But I loved it visually because it's blue, and then it's got stripes of red and white. And I just thought that was fantastic. I also found it on Flickr, and this was a Flickr success story. It was a restricted rights, but I emailed the person who took the photo, and she said, sure, you can use it, just give me credit. So credit where credit is due. And so we started playing around with the visual elements. This is kind of a weird way to back into the topic, but I think it's appropriate. And I've got this, I juxtaposed it on our banner, which is still on our homepage, with the American flag, which was visually great. But then some of the folks began to raise questions about this. They said, Steve, is it really just about America? And they said, but does the American flag really stand for democracy anymore? And I said, well, that's a good question. Maybe we should leave it up there and see what kind of conversation it provokes. But what I did want to do is start off the conversation by actually first broadening it so that we're not talking just about the U.S. and just about U.S. politics. And so I sat down with Rebecca McKinnon before she headed off for Hong Kong to teach, and did a brief interview with her. And I really liked what she said on the topic of how we understand politics more broadly than just electoral politics, because, of course, in the Chinese context, there is not much freedom to really shape the outcome of elections, and pushing something to the point of regime change is a huge change. But there's a lot of other things that go on. So this is a brief clip from that. So I'm a neophyte when it comes to understanding Chinese politics, but Eric Priest brought up this example last week at Cyber Scholars, and I'm eternally grateful for him for turning me on to this. I don't know if Rebecca would agree with me on this one, but the story of this song is... You know, so the story of this song is that this relatively unknown Chinese girl, correct me if I get the story wrong, created a song. She uploaded the MP3 to a free service, freely downloadable, and by some accounts, it's been downloaded more than 1 billion times. Out of this, she got a record deal, and she created her own album. But what's the content of what she's singing about? What is the significance? Well, so the song is Song of Pig, hugely popular. Is this significant? And in the way that Rebecca explained the larger dynamics within China, does this matter politically? Well, the hypothesis of the conference that we'll be examining, and this is a question, just like Jake said last year, it was a question, is that skills that emerge in the course of participating in pop culture broadly defined, can become powerful forces when translated into tools of citizen engagement. And in the case of Song of Pig, even just creating and distributing that song may be a political act. What is that?
Do you know what? They've now censored any cartoons of pigs.
You know that? No.
Because it's offensive to the Muslim community. It's the year of the pig.
Ah.
And so, it's very interesting.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
There was actually a piece on NPR this morning about it, and you can probably go online and
About Song of Pig?
About it. It mentioned Song of Pig, and it also talked about confusion in the advertising world with what sorts of images of pigs you can use, especially because people are creating commercials around the new year and the year of the pig.
That creates a whole new dynamic. I didn't even have
that. Well, that actually
no
ties into this quite
so.
Well.
Yeah,
actually,
does.
I realize, yeah. It does. Because there's an intersection there.
Yeah.
Actually, that's right.
So the question is, what about participatory pop culture? And this raises questions of what do we do in terms of media literacy in an era of digital natives? And John Palfrey talks about this a lot, of course. What does it mean to have the core skills of citizenship when the media landscape is participatory and two-way? And that's part of what we're trying to engage. So there are two halves to the conference: participatory culture, participatory democracy. On the first side, we have the first of two panels, each named for half of that balance. On the first side, one of our guests is this filmmaking duo, Four Eyed Monsters. They made a feature film independently. They shopped it around at different film festivals. It got some play. It got several awards, but they never got picked up by a major distributor. So instead of giving up at this point, they decided to take it to the web. And they created a website where they have a Google Maps mashup where you can vote to see the film in your city. And once they get enough votes in a particular city, they schedule a screening at a theater. They started doing a video podcast. The first day that iTunes supported video podcasts, they did their first episode, and they do them every week or two. And they've also continue to edit the film after the initial version, and they've started to include bits and pieces from things that their viewers out there in the world have submitted back to them. They have a MySpace page, they get video comments back, and they're sort of building a movement around their film. They recently were picked up to be shown on the Sundance Channel. They've won a couple more awards. And we'll have them participating by video chat at the conference. They're by a video chat because they're actually in LA at another awards festival, waiting to find out if they're gonna win for a couple things they were nominated there. So this is definitely within the sphere of entertainment, but a lot of the characteristics of what they're doing resemble political movements or policy advocacy or things like that. and they've actually translated it across. But let's look at the political side, or the explicitly political side. So everybody knows the famed YouTube macaca phenomenon. This is one that's very clear. It clearly had an effect on the election. It was covered on CNN. Obviously, something is happening here. But if we step a little bit further back, this video still is, obviously, it looks like it's from C-SPAN. It's actually been taken from this site, MetaVid, which is archiving all floor footage from C-SPAN on their website. This is a project that's funded by the Sunlight Foundation. They were here showcasing their site a couple weeks ago at the Berkman Sunlight event. And so you can search in various ways through all of this C-SPAN footage. The net effect of this, going from something like C-SPAN, which in the broadcast model is terribly boring and hard to sift through and relies on watching it in real time in order to be able to keep track of what are sometimes very important things in the mix of a lot of other nonsense, is very difficult in the broadcast model. But once you can start to search, once you can excerpt, once you can link to it, once you can embed the video in your web pages, you can start to have a conversation around these things and say, hey, look, this is what my senator said, or this is an issue that I care about. Here are all the relevant video clips. So I think that's significant. This is a video made by Aaron Crumley, who's one of the two filmmakers from Four Eyed Monsters. And this is actually sort of transitioning over onto the political side, something he put up on his site. Got a whole bunch of video replies back and got a lot of attention around it.
That gets you nowhere, I guess, in that phenomenon, a little bit better, but
So this is a net neutrality advocacy video, basically. And he goes on, he shows the site. This is pretty famous because, you know, he starts crying, he brings in the music. It's satire, but it's advocacy. And so I talked to him about this, and he said, you know, one of the important things for kids who are starting to get into producing their own media is to just do it. Even if you don't have an issue that's really important to you right now, it's important to establish the sort of the core skills of doing this. Even if you're doing it about something that you don't think is really important, then when something that you think is important comes along, you have the opportunity to talk about it. So this one was on, So this next one was on YouTube. It was featured yesterday. It was the top featured video. And it's part of this long string of conversation that's been happening on YouTube through videos and video comments about, are there enough black people on YouTube? And why are they featured? And is it Black History Month even on YouTube? So I love this one.
Today, and the YouTube operation. This momentum came can have 2 million of elderly men who have been trained in the flames of withering bad television. Yet pain came as a giant daybreak to end the moonlight of boredom in front of their computer screen. But we are there. The Negro is still not on the front page. 2 years later, the life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of booty shaking videos and the chains of discrimination. I am not unmindful that some of you have come here with a great deal of tribulation. Some of you have come fresh from slow internet connections. And some of you have come from areas where your quest for cheaper internet connections left you battered by the stones of greedy telecommunication companies and staggered by the winds of overcharging telephone companies. And so, even though we face the difficulty of 500 server error today and tomorrow, I still have a dream.
So I love this video because, you know, it's entertaining, obviously, it's satire. He's bringing up important issues, at least within the domain of YouTube users that really value who gets featured on the homepage. You know, he's slipping in a little bit of policy advocacy there, but it's not necessarily something which says, this is politics and I'm going to do politics now. And it's also part of something that's become a sort of established habit of creating videos and replying to them on YouTube. It's sort of part of everyday life. So Henry Jenkins, who's the director of the CMS program, will be speaking, giving the keynote and sort of laying out the hypothesis I've talked about. Part of what he says is the emergence of new media technologies supports a democratic urge to allow more people to create and circulate media. And that's his Second Life avatar there. It's pretty accurate. That's pretty much what he looks like. So the questions are I have for you today, and really the conference is sort of a hypothesis that's trying to test these possibilities. Are what are the ways that these changes in media affect politics and potentially give us a better society? Is one of them that it increases the transparency of politics? We saw a lot of projects doing that in the recent sort of Berkman Sunlight exchange, and they're doing a lot of really exciting stuff with sort of Open Congress, all sorts of stuff about looking at where the money goes, collaborative wiki-based legislation, things like that. Is that actually happening, or is this a lot of hype? Does it have the potential to strengthen the voice of the underheard? Our I have a YouTube dream guy. Is that real, or is that just play? And if it's play, does that mean that it doesn't matter? And does it have the opportunity to renew or create new habits of citizenship? This is sort of the Tocquevillian approach. Beyond what we create in terms of law, or beyond what we do in terms of electoral politics or how those come out, how does it affect our habits as we relate to the rest of society? And are those habits really changing, and do we really have an opportunity to do that? So that's part of what we will be discussing at Beyond Broadcast. Very briefly, the way that we're structuring the day is the first half will be the keynote and a couple of plenaries, and the second half of the day will be entirely comprised of working groups. And these groups will break out, address different topics. We're soliciting people's ideas for what they want to do for working groups on the website. And in addition to those sort of three broad general questions, one thing I'd love to hear about from you guys is what should we make sure we cover in the working groups topic-wise? What are important domains that should be discussed in this space? And I'll show you where those, the list of where those working groups are at right now. But then I'm interested in your feedback, questions, et cetera. So this, sorry, it's kind of small. So this is the current list on the wiki. You can go to beyondbroadcast.net. There's a link to the wiki. There's a link directly to the working group page, too. And you can add your own, edit them, stuff like that. So my first question is, do you buy it? Does engagement with popular culture mean that we have the opportunity to develop new skills that translate into better citizenship?
First, I have a comment, and then...
Sure.
I did enjoy that gentleman's talk when he his satire. But actually, I go to YouTube as a relief from the gangster filth that I usually have to see on the, you know, and I will get things like Stevie Wonder's rendition of Superstition on Sesame Street, 1973, you know, just as a relief, an old music, jazz and things. But the point I really enjoyed was there's a young Iraqi American who has done an amazing video called Iraq, and he's from San Diego, and he's it's Tim's on YouTube, and it's wonderful to hear that a lot of apparently his feedback. I think it's timsonline.com. I don't know, but he's had quite a number of the troops that have written him because they like the song so much, and even though he's a rapper, he talks about the issue about being not a Democrat or a Republican, but being an Iraqi American and the effect it's having on his family.
Is that right?
And yes, it's excellent. If you want to play it, it's on you. You can do YouTube and just put TIMZ. Thankfully, there's no expletives or it's just, yes.
So,
oh, that's not the whole video. That's just when he's interviewing. I forgot to tell you about that one too, where he makes Chuck Norris look like an idiot. But if you play his actual video, yes.
So how did this guy get?
Well, that's what I was going to say about politics. He got it through YouTube. He was just an underground rapper, and then he decided to make this amazing video, and it spiraled. And the troops were saying that they loved it, and a lot of people, some people are objected to it, but because it's not anti-American, he's just saying, look, you know, then, and I think it helps. It's just saying, you know, you're hurting America by doing this, and it's quite. I've found it extraordinarily remarkable work.
Yeah.
So, well, if I recommend it highly, that for me, in terms of further my feelings about the war, just confirmed by this very prolific young man. That's what I'm saying.
And I think one interesting thing that's at work in this case is the interaction between the sort of YouTube-esque bottom-up media forms and the broadcast media. I mean, the clip on YouTube here is from Fox. Obviously, he's gotten a huge amount of coverage, and you know, in some sense, the bottom up sort of participatory media is an open gatekeeper, and then as these sort of rise to the top, then our traditional broadcast media amplify them, which is a different story than you hear from people who say, you know, broadcast media is dead or dying. And then in the other direction, I think the other interesting thing, which we see now. With Chuck Norris here, is going in the other direction, which is going from broadcast media back down to participatory media as a way of commenting on it and continuing the conversation after the fact. So I think that's a great example. So what should we make sure to cover? What are we missing?
The first question. Do people buy this? That was one.
Well, it's still exclusive, but it's more inclusive.
I mean, I certainly do. I think that one of the things that's different is that people, they when they don't have a political issue, you know, they're learning the sort of about pop culture. It's very easy to quickly turn political with the skills that you have. I mean, it's very, I guess it's sort of, it's easy to organize. I mean, it's far.
Right. Yeah, Ethan, is Ethan here today?
No.
My favorite story that Ethan Zuckerman, a fellow here, tells is that he had, this is not translating into the political space, but it has to do with this process. He had some job that he needed done. It was sort of rote, you know, copy editing or something like that, data entry. And he had to do it in a very short period of time for whatever reason. And
data entry post-Katrina.
Yes, data entry post-Katrina, that's what it was. And so he didn't know what to do. He didn't know, how do I find the people that I need? I need to turn this around really quickly. He turned to his wife, who's a fan fiction author. She has this huge community of friends online, other fan fiction authors. And he said, are you guys interested in a job? I know what you do mostly is fan fiction, but I've got this other thing that I need help with. And of course, she was able to mobilize a huge network of people very quickly, and they got the job done. If you imagine turning that kind of energy on politics, it's kind of exciting. Anyway, sorry, I cut you off. But
yeah, no, I just think that political movements can come out of nowhere immediately. I mean, which is, and it's not just political. It's, I mean, people can organize for anything. I mean, there, you know, it's, I think it's a, similar to the whole idea of citizen journalism. I mean, there was a great example a couple of weeks ago using Facebook, where people, there was a group of kids going to a school, and a bus caught on fire, got it exploded or something like that, and all the coverage of the bus explosion was on Facebook.
Yeah.
So, and you know, I think it's, you know, there
and then probably the eventually thing. Made its way up to the local TV channels and things like that, I would imagine. So the proposition in the Academy that that popular culture is significant and worth studying is not, still not an easy case to make. And that it's, in fact, important to our lives and sort of civil society. But nobody's giving me much resistance here, and I'm kind of surprised. Are we all believers?
What are the objections?
Well, I'll take the other side of that.
There we go.
Yeah, I've been thinking about it. I mean, there's a presumption that if there's a real resistance, and I'd go back to Rebecca's point in certain societies, and that, okay, you can let someone go so far, and then it becomes a real issue of power and influence, and how do you translate that into real political power and influence? And you may look at a popular culture and let them do what they want, you know. I mean, and historically, you can see that. I mean, and so it isn't necessarily an automatic transition, I don't think. I mean, that's what we assume in our culture. But, I mean, if it tightens up here, I just don't think it's an automatic thing. I mean, I agree with certain premises. Yes, you get the skills, you get the influence. But that's predicated in a lot of other institutional structures staying in place.
Right.
And when it really, I mean, it really comes push to shove at some point, then it's not clear to me that it would be.
Right. Yeah. If we just stay
if you know, I mean, you're assuming certain constancies, and so I think that could change. What?
Your comment that does not make sense if you're under 40. I called you an ignorant slut. You went
right.
Nothing new.
It's a very disturbing comment. So one could, I mean, we could see YouTube, etc., as a great distraction. It distracts the masses from serious issues. It lets us, as a distraction. And there may be truth to that, I don't know. But it seems to me also at the same time that having YouTube available, et cetera, and having blogs available, just the So when, as the media were consolidating, the public did not rise up as one and say, oh no, my newspaper is gone, or now it's,
right.
It happens. It if somebody tried to take your blogs away or shut down YouTube, there would be. So in some sense, the ability to have voice, I mean, literal voice in the case of media, I think has a very direct effect on changing your sense of participation in the culture, which is, I think, fundamental to democracy.
And totally agree with that. I'm not arguing. I'm just arguing it, but I'm just saying there's an automatic assumption that there you know, bad things happen. Anyway.
Just in order to make it slightly more productive, reframe it slightly. So I think it's hard to say, at least in the self-selecting group in the room, that right. This isn't worth studying, because that's why we're here for lunch, right? We think it's interesting. there clearly is something happening here, and it's clearly transformative in some fashion to our relationship as individuals to various different institutions, right? I think a much harder question is, it's not even whether it's affecting politics. I think it is affecting the political landscape, and I think it's hard to say it's not relevant. I think it's a much harder question, though, to say, is it good for democracy? And I think it's a much harder question to say, is it unalloyed good? Is it something that we can correct for? What do we mean by democracy? I think at that level of questions, it's much trickier. So I think at that point, you get into Cass Sunstein's critiques in The Daily Me and in Infotopia and so forth. I think you get into the Tower of Babel-type critiques. I think you get into some of the critiques that say this is actually really lazy political activism. You know, there are a bunch of different things that you could say that is, as we make this translation, that it's, there are a bunch of good things, creativity and so forth, but there are also things that at the end of it, we may not be glad of what we brought. Now, I don't happen to buy that myself, but I think that line of critique is fruitful. I mean, Yochai Benkler in his book, Wealth of Networks, takes up each of these, I think, you know, pretty effectively.
On my John Henry, I was actually going to bring this up and add a part of it, which is, I think that it's, I mean, two things, I guess. One, which is, this is, in the case of the Iraqi rapper, you were looking at something that Fox News was rebroadcasting, right? So they were actually empowering him by rebroadcasting that and actually drawing attention to it, where when he posted it, it's a singular, and you have to actually go search that out to go find it, be interested in it to go find it. Where it's something where it's broadcast, you know, it's maybe playing, maybe receptive, slightly easier. So that's one thing. And the other thing is, John brought up, it sort of dilutes almost the message, because you have so many people actually going out and saying, like, this is what I think democracy is, or this is what I'm going to draw public attention to. And instead of bringing the issue to a point, you bring the issue to everyone, and everyone has their own message. So instead of unifying a cause, you actually dilute the cause completely, because everyone has their own agenda.
Right. But doesn't that depend on whether these things respond to each other and go towards a point, or whether they're divergent and talk past each other? I mean, isn't... That assumption is no more.
The key assumption is that this is a conversation. And if you look at a lot of blogs and you look at a lot of videos on YouTube, while there are conversations, a lot of them are flame wars. And what are flame wars? Just people yelling and not listening. So the assumption is that people are very, you know, participating. And people are listening back on the comments that they receive while, you know, not...
Right.
Yeah, I'm trying to find the thread on the I Have a Dream YouTube video. I showed a good one, but there, for every good video that's thoughtful and well-produced and funny, there are 10 other flamers and just unadulterated outright racism, too, replying to this guy. And so I think that YouTube is not necessarily one of those technologies that's gotten that balance right, where it encourages working together and consensus and respect. And so that may not be the best reflection of democracy at work.
Now, I don't want to indict our political system, but that to me doesn't sound unlike the ratio that we might see in other settings, right? I mean, is that any different from anything else? I don't know.
No, but I'm just saying...
Yeah.
Another potential critique is the medium in which it's happening. I mean, we all love Google, but it is happening within not within the public space. I mean,
right.
part.
Right, and that gets back to the question of what right. public media is sort of extending right. from last year. And does do the objectives of Google match with the objectives of American democracy and civil society, or do they match more closely with the shareholder profit?
And
so you know, right, right, right. That's true. I think you have.
I wanted to say I think participatory culture and democracy are very different things, and it's important not to gloss them together just because we often stick participatory before each of them. A playground is a great example of a very open participatory culture, and it doesn't usually lead to democracy or lasting interest in politics or a sense of shared sovereignty or even shared set of goals for people to work on. It's really easy to go and find out what anyone's doing and take part in it if you want to. But the democracy and just the political aspects are very distinct. So I think there are two discussions that should be separated, and one is what happens when you encourage the formation of very large networks so that anything one person wants can then be broadcast across 1,000 people. And then separate from that, what happens when you try to improve participation in democracy?
Right.
Someone's written on this, Eleanor Ostrom did it. She's done a lot of comments.
That's sort of her thing. And did a sort of historical analysis of participation in school boards and sort of civic participation and how enormous deterioration in this country. So people really don't have the skills in a sense to really understand what budgets are about and the whole kind of governance. And it's not clear to me whether, you know, this kind of participation translates into that kind of participation. I mean, I live in a small New England town. You have selectmen and everything else. And it really depends upon people taking a lot of their time out and being responsible for the governance. And that's a different kind of skill than sort of posting right. you know, popular culture stuff. And in action, there's a deterioration. You can see real differences in generations around that. So I think you have to be careful as to you know, this whole notion of participation. On the other hand, I'm optimistic. Well, I do think there is a new kind of governance, a new kind of civic society is coming out of this. But I think it's like post-democratic. It's something new.
I think you have to be careful about using YouTube as a proxy for popular culture, because there are a lot of different forms of new media that are popular culture. I mean, I think you could just as easily focus exclusively on Facebook as popular culture. And that, I would argue that has more of the skills of using that and being part of the community around you there are more closely aligned and transferable to...
So there's a sense of governance, responsibility, well, community.
I mean, you know, I think there's certainly Facebook? A sense of responsibility. I mean, you know, you develop an identity, and I mean, that's an important part of acting in a community too. So I mean, I guess the broader point is that being you know, facile in popular culture requires being facile in a whole series of platforms, not only YouTube, but Facebook, but MySpace, but Google, and managing all of those different platforms is you accumulate skills that I think are all very social, and that's the core of being part of a community.
So what about Facebook makes it a better example of something leaning towards democratic participation?
Why does it have to be political? Like, I think why does, like, the governing I mean, why it's social more than political, I think, and the skills are social and working with your community as opposed to a political dance. I think
an important distinction about Facebook is that it's tied with your real name and, like, your real geographic, real world communities, like your whatever school you go to, or, you know, every community sure. that you're associated with is exists in real life, pretty much, which is not the case in YouTube, where you can just have an anonymous alias.
So I'm surprised to hear no one saying it's exciting to have all these people who might not otherwise be participating in any sort of political speech, whatever you define political as, whether it's about net neutrality or something that might be construed as less political and more social, but right. still expressing themselves in whatever medium that they can express themselves in, which may not be the medium that we're most familiar with, which is, you know, the written word, but maybe it's these other forms. And no one is excited about that. No one sees some sort of opportunity in engaging more people meaningfully and alternatively in different viewpoints and different kind of ways of conveying those viewpoints as kind of being a potential political or democratic step forward in this culture or in other cultures?
One nice facet of that is that I think a lot of folks are developing an assumption that they can participate. I think Henry Jenkins made a great point in Convergence Culture, which I just finished, so now I'm an addict, the point with the Sims-Alphaville elections, how people who participated in that of all ages and locations came out of it feeling that that it was their right to participate in culture and in democracy, and it was assumed, and now they were shocked when in sort of real life they didn't have the opportunities, or they might not have the opportunities that they had in the virtual life. So I think that attitude and cultivating that belief system, whether or not people realize that it's actually being cultivated, is a very powerful thing.
And so just on Sunday, right, the Super Bowl has, you know, user-generated ads or user-inspired ads. So the ultimate point of consuming commercials, which we really just swallow, now where people are kind of even participating in that. And you got to wonder if that does start to get into your mind that you can create things as well. And I don't see how that could be at least somewhat empowering. Now, to what ends people think that is.
And I think the risks to that happening in a way that engages the citizens, a diverse set of citizens, come from, you know, what we traditionally called things like digital divide, which is a problematic term.
The way that Henry talks about it in Convergence Culture is in terms of the participation gap. Now that the majority of people, at least in the U.S., have some mechanism for getting access to the internet, albeit maybe only while they're at school or only through a slow dial-up connection or only through the local library, the question is, what kind of habits do they have around their use of that media? And if you only have access through school for a limited number of hours a day, or you only have access through school, but a lot of sites, including MySpace, are blocked, what kind of habits does that engender? And so I think that's one of the big risks to whether or not we, in general, equally across society, start to develop these sorts of habits that resemble democratic participation, or at least can be translated more readily into democratic participation, or if it is just the domain of the people who have high-speed access in the home. And I don't know as much about what to do about that. that's a difficult one.
I think about it, like, what are the barriers right now for participation? And I think some of that is just literacy, you know, just basic literacy. And that, oh, we're adding this digital literacy, is a whole other level of putting a whole other group of people sort of behind the curve. And I think I get excited about this kind of stuff and the possibility of it, but it's not just a, you know, it's not just a class thing, but it's also an age thing. I think, you know, this might not be representative, but I think, you know, my dad versus my grandmother versus me versus, you know, an 18-year-old using this kind of stuff is a very, I think it's getting more and more skewed younger and, you know, more access and more education, and I'm worried about everybody else other than that. So who's on YouTube and who's speaking and who's participating versus who's not. I worry about who's not.
I think, too, to some extent, I'm wondering about how the right to recognition of your right to participate actually translates into action or duty to participate. So the fact that you know that I could now use this media for political action, would that be limited to certain things like net neutrality or, you know, things that would directly impinge on that specific right, or would it actually translate into broader areas of advocacy or activism? So there's still that collective action barrier to activating the right.
Right. Right.
Yeah, I'd love to briefly mention. Yeah.
How many people and how many sessions? I'm
sorry. So we have the total number of attendees will be about 350, and the working groups are fairly flexible.
If anyone wants to start their
If you want to start your own, it's beyondbroadcast.net, and there's a link to the wiki. So right now, these are the ones that are starting to come together or have been suggested by people. The first one with games extends on actually a working group we had last year. And I didn't actually write this one, so let's see what the... this year's working group will focus on another potential use of virtual world gaming community tools and technologies to create deliberately designed experiential learning environments for civic engagement. So the facilitator has written a bunch of starting questions. So that's the first one. The future of public access. This is going to be an interesting one. I'm looking forward to this. So Dan Gilmore is going to issue a sort of provocative proposal to public access. And I don't want to steal his thunder, but it's fair to say that the public access folks may not be too keen on this idea. And Jason Crow from CCTV here locally will be a co-facilitator with him, and they'll sort of talk about what's the future of public access. I did, actually. They're talking to each other over email, so... there's a lot of interest in how public broadcasting will cover the upcoming election. What are the innovative ways that they're doing so? What are they doing with their websites, et cetera? And, wow, a bunch of people are signing up and commenting since I last looked. Oh, this is one I'm excited about, but I haven't put any description in yet. Tim Carr, who's the director for Save the Internet, which is the net neutrality advocacy group that Aaron made that video for, which has been successful in mobilizing a lot of people around this rather obscure political, technical issue. Largely through the use of blogs and YouTube videos and things like that. They've got, I think, you know, over 100 independent people out there in the world have made YouTube videos in favor of this issue. Is going to talk about what it's like to try to organize a movement using online tools. And I'm sure we'll get into some of the content of the policy, but my primary interest is in what's the structure of organizing this kind of a group and what makes for successful translation into actual policy. We'll be looking at media literacy and the law, what issues come up when either trying to use media in the classroom or when trying to teach media literacy or get students to participate, what they bump into. Pat Ofterheide from Center for Social Media, which is also a sponsor this year and helped organize last year, will lead that with a couple people, including someone from Comparative Media Studies New Media Literacies Research Group. This next one, I believe, will happen, although we're still confirming that everyone wants to do it. The description I wrote was, partisan politics aside, if such a thing is possible, what makes for authentic political participation online? I hope to have Zephyr Teachout, who was a Berkman Fellow, now works for Sunlight Foundation and was director of internet organizing for Dean, co-lead it with Chuck DeFeo, who was here for the 2004 Internet Society Conference. And was Bush Cheney e-campaign manager. Talk about what does participation look like? How can we encourage that while not getting tangled up in the particular politics of it? This will be interesting. We may also have they're also talking to each other on email. We may also have someone representing a third party. Here too, but he hasn't confirmed yet. Local efforts that mix web 2.0 and 1.0, public radio and open source. This is more focused on developers, software developers, and how public radio can make use of open source tools. Elizabeth Stark from Harvard Free Culture will lead one on free culture and activism, and I guess Kevin Driscoll confirmed that he will also be co-leading. Another one where the potential participants are talking to each other over email is the video on the net, which I've tentatively called Beyond YouTube? We've got some folks representing non-YouTube video sites. Blip TV, which is definitely a YouTube competitor. Click TV, which also allows commentary and feedback while you're watching it, and is a competitor with Blip in some sense. And then it looks like someone from Rever, which is also in this space, will be there. So I'm interested in throwing them together and seeing what happens. Urs, who's a fellow here, will be leading one on law and participatory culture. There's a description, full description there. The global conversation, Ethan will be leading, and Bruno may be helping over video chat. And then virtual world, so we're going to project, or we're going to stream the conference into Second Life again on Berkman's virtual island. Rodica, who is a Second Lifer extraordinaire, will be helping us with that and leading hybrid working groups, which will probably be partially in real life and in Second Life, and probably talking about virtual worlds. I think that'll be a very interesting one too. So if there's anything I'm missing, thoughts, suggestions, if you want to help facilitate one of these, let me know. Yeah.
Say no. I'm not sure that I want to participate in this topic.
Oh, okay. We'll add a suggestion.
Putting my name as a placeholder.
We'll find someone.
Not putting my name in.
We'll find someone to lead it.
On we'll say still wait. sounds awful. The metadata we need in order to facilitate the things that we want.
Yes.
You have nothing to say on that topic.
Favorite metadata. I don't have any topic.
Yeah, I agree. So, metadata and standards, perhaps more broadly. If we can't talk to each other, how do we talk?
Some of the Sunlight Labs folks, some of the folks who came to the Sunlight event might be interested in that too.
Yes.
SJ, weren't you going to put one up?
I was. I was looking at the global conversation. I wonder what Ethan means by that. But it occurs to me one thing that we didn't talk very much about is that as we break down these participatory culture walls, people outside what would normally be considered political groups have a lot of say in how discussions go, and they can provide a lot of perspective and feedback. So an interesting question for me is both how you teach people about participatory politics and what it means to participate, not just in the U.S., but in countries where people might not have a local voice, but they can have a global voice, and then how you teach people here, how you teach people in your community, how to bridge that gap from participating in culture to actually being involved.
Right, right.
So I'd love to see something that's really about education.
Yeah.
And I'd be happy to lead a working group on that if it doesn't fall into one of the others.
Yeah, one I haven't added to the list yet, but we started talking about, which may be related to this, so at the Sunlight event, you're going to have to remind me. We had a couple high school students join us, which were very articulate and opinionated, and just really injected life into the conversation. So they will be coming back for Beyond Broadcast, and they've been doing an independent project where they are sort of redesigning textbooks based on sort of local community factors. Is that an accurate rendering? I think I'm getting that right. But essentially they're saying, what's wrong with textbooks? How would we write it if we wrote our own textbook? And so maybe there's a tie-in there. Maybe there's a tie-in with One Laptop Per Child. Something about the future of textbooks, the future of learning, something along those lines.
They have continued the work that began in the IT Leadership Academy, which is where this institutional home is, and created their own independent project effort to generate community-based textbooks that more adequately address the cultural perspectives of highly diverse communities in public education. The main idea these students are working on is that self-determined learning arises out of participatory culture. This leads naturally to a more vibrant civic participation.
The question is whether our existing institutions are prepared to accept this socioeconomic shift, or if incumbent interests see this as more threat than promise. In any case, these are like high-powered, super cool, smart young gals who we invited to kind of participate in whatever way they wanted, whether it was making media or leading a workshop. And I think you would be a fabulous partner for them,
yeah,
if you're interested.
Where were you meeting that from?
That's from an email from the guy, the director of the program.
Great.
So I will introduce you.
More ideas are welcome. Please add them to the site. I need to run off pretty soon, so we should wrap up in a couple minutes. But
Rory, maybe I'm missing it. My personal interest in terms of participating or being in a democracy is with the increasing consolidation of media, like reading the Phoenix article about the Globe laying off yet another 100 or so people in the Herald, and you know, it just seems that it's getting smaller and smaller and smaller. It's like, where do you get your information from? That they're covering narrower and narrower interests that are of no interest or concern to me, or they're general concern, but I have other concerns besides what is covered. If I have more foreign concerns and they're cutting the foreign bureaus, I'm not getting that support. So I'm forced to go to alternative sources online. If I want to get stream Al Jazeera English, I have to go online. I have to go to YouTube. I have to go to BBC, like NPR. I constantly have to go to alternative sources to find out what I need in order to be an active citizen in my own country. So I don't know where that fits, but that's where I feel like, you know, I'm considered a consumption unit, not a citizen as an American anymore.
Yeah.
Like whether I go shopping is more important than whether I actually participate.
Right.
You know, where's the home for me?
Yeah.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time. I heard Rebecca McKinnon speak at the Shorenstein Center.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the issues they were talking about with Arianna Huffington, Huffington Post, and the late Molly Ivins, God rest her soul, and E.J. Dionne. They were talking about, you know, and people who work for the L.A. Times, you know, chiefs who have quit, the gentleman who quit instead of laying off all those people. I've been on study groups and sitting in the meetings with Marty Baron right here at the Globe. Yeah. Marcy Boulevard, and it's and also it's very depressing when they're looking at a business model for like who when you say you're journalists, how can I trust the source of the journalism?
Right.
Where yes, I'm more inclined to go to a blog for an Iraqi or somebody from Iran who's worried about them being the next people who are going to be bombed than I'm going to go to an American. But nevertheless, how do you source things so that I can be an active make intelligent decisions about being.
Yeah, I think we need to add some kind of a working group on that theme, definitely.
Oh, good. Good.
So, if you think of a good title, that's the key. You have to need a good.
Okay.
But or I'll try to figure out a way to phrase it. John?
Excellent.
I know you have to go, but just a tiny last comment to follow up on this one, which is there have been a lot of conversations around this topic, and I think you've done a wonderful job in the presentation of bringing forward the conversation from Beyond Broadcast to this year. But I would just encourage, as you do this conference, to make it as synthetic as you possibly can, which is to say, go back and get clips from the Shorenstein Center stuff, from the WebCred conference we've had, from the INS Politics when we did in 04 and so forth, and just try to kind of be clear about moving the conversation forward as much as possible. You know, pull in Yochai's book, pull in Henry's book, you know, whatever the things are that are sort of icons out there of the conversation, and try to be sure to be driving a thread forward, because I think that it's an amazing topic, but it's also, and I'm doing a whole course on it this spring, but it's also one that you can get turned around in, drawn in lots of directions and so forth. Yeah, exactly, and I think you've got a great opportunity here to...
That's a very good point.
Mm-hmm. That's excellent.
But bravo. Well done.
All right. Maybe on that note, like we should let Steve get off to his next appointment and thank him and thank all of you for your participation
today. Thank you very much.